The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora, unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right.
That's right. That's right. We have got to stop the fussing and the fighting. And it just seems like this country is on fire, you all. But there are some people who have a vision. There are some people who believe they have a pathway. And there are some people who are committed to working for a more just society. And so here we are. This is the show, Voices from the Battlefield, that connect the various struggles around the country and sometimes around the world. But we focus in on those folks who are actually organizing for change. So there's lots of folks out there talking and lots of folks out there sitting. But there are some people that are doing the work. And so we have two of them with us today, and we're going to get to them. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. And, you know, I just want to remind you all that we still have a serial liar and 34-time convicted felon in the White House that is wreaking havoc on this country. And we need not to forget that, because what's happening in Los Angeles is just another indication of the unbridled power that Trump is unleashing. And most folks have figured it out that this overreach is really not about safety and security of folks in LA. It is about how far Trump can go before he gets stopped. And I believe exactly what Mayor Karen said, that, you know, it's a test case. And if they're able to ignore the law that requires certain things to happen before you bring the National Guard in, let alone the U.S. Marines, then you're going to have a problem. And so we are watching that situation carefully. Those protests have spread across the country. And I do want to let people know that, or remind some people, that the reason that this has become an issue is because the president said that he was going after the most dangerous criminals. And what people begin to find out is that was not the case. And so we have to wonder, where are the dangerous criminals? Because they're swooping down on Home Depots where day laborers come who've been, you know, working every day hard, doing some of the work that a lot of us don't want to do. And so now people are realizing, wait a minute, that's my neighbor. That's my church member. That's my little league coach. What is going on? So now you see a whole different kind of thing going on in this country, y'all. And I'm just happy that people are pulling back the curtains to see what it is. I might also add, some of you all who stay on social media, that there are some black voices that are saying this is not our issue. Now, what we found out over the last couple of years is some of these folks are paid to confuse and give out disinformation. And I'm not saying all, but if you say that immigration is not a black issue, then you don't really understand who the immigrants are. All you got to do, for example, is look at who doesn't get in this country. And also with the latest, you know, no travel, you see that most of those countries are black and brown. So I have lots of Ethiopian folks, Haitian folks, all kind of folks that, you know, are immigrants in here. They have an African descent, y'all. So this is definitely a black issue. And yes, we are supporting the protests all across the country. Black people are. So those folks who want to say this is not our issue, that's another attempt at disinformation. So we need to ignore that and do what's in our heart, do what's in our political interest. And it is to support A, First Amendment rights, and B, you know, lawful implementation of the Constitution, which the president seems to be ignoring. So having said all of that, and knowing that the planet is on fire, and sometimes it's literally on fire, and sometimes that's based on what corporations and government has allowed to happen in our communities. So we have two people today who are from organizations that are fighting for environmental justice, and they come from different parts of the country. They've been around for different spaces of time, but the issue is really still the same. And remember, this is not our first time exploring this issue. We had Tina Cordova from the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. We had her on right after the big hoopla around Oppenheimer, when people were thinking or told that none of the testing in those southwest states affected real people, real communities. And she's a victim of the testing, the radiation, as is her family, as is generations of the folks who lived in Tularosa. So this is not new. Closer to home is the whole spraying Pruitt-Igoe housing project back in the 50s with a toxic chemical that we still, to this day, don't know what it was. What we do know is the results of that spray, where children who were out there playing, inhaling it, playing on the ground in the dirt, began to have serious complications with respiratory ailments and later on different kinds of cancers. So the reason that this is important for us, y'all, this is the only planet we have. If we don't take care of it, we have nowhere else to go. Those folks are trying to get up to space, they're not going to include us. They're going to mess up this planet, and then they're going to have someplace else to go, and we'll be left here with the damage. But we got two people here that can talk about this very good, very well, very extensively. And so we want to welcome Kristen Camuso, who's with the Missouri Coalition for the Environment. And a friend from the South is Keyshawn Pearson, who's with Memphis Community Against Pollution. And I'm just going to, throughout the show, just say MCAP, because is that what y'all say? Keyshawn, do y'all?
That's right, MCAP, that's us.
Okay, because I don't know if I will get all those words out at one time, but both of you all are involved in struggle with folks on the ground, lawmakers, policymakers. I'm going to start with you, Kristen, because you all have been around for a while. People who know Coalition for the Environment know that some of the world-renowned founders, Kay and Leo Dre, if you hadn't heard of them in St. Louis, or you haven't heard of Times Beach, you know, contaminated by dioxin, then you really haven't been paying attention in St. Louis. So for at least, 50 years, Kristen, you all have been on the ground. So tell people what the Coalition for the Environment does.
First, thank you for having me, and also a quick shout out to Tina Cordova from the Tularosa Basin. We've worked very closely with that group. She's absolutely amazing. So Missouri Coalition for the Environment, MCE for short, we are a statewide nonprofit organization that works to organize and advance meaningful policy that protects Missourians and their environment. We were founded back in 1969, a few years before even the EPA was enacted. We work on a variety of issues, starting at the local level and on up through the federal government. Things around climate change, concentrated animal feeding operations, or factory farms, as they're sometimes called. And more specifically, the work that I do is around hazardous waste contamination from the Manhattan Project and Cold War era. It's a little known fact that St. Louis was the very first corporation, or I should say Mallinckrodt Chemical Works, based in St. Louis, was the very first corporation to purify the uranium needed for the United States nuclear weapons arsenals, and that created tens of thousands of tons of radioactive waste that now litters our community.
Wow. So I'm I think in the last maybe several months, people have seen Coldwater Creek be featured on the news and finally getting the attention of the government to do something about it. What's MCAP doing? And you all were founded in 2020, so maybe not the same longevity, but you all have been making some waves down there in Memphis. What's going on, Keyshawn?
Hey, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Your show is amazing and is a pillar of justice and truth. And so we need more folks like you. And so just glad to be here and have been invited on your show. At Memphis Community Against Pollution, we started out as an organization of people in a community who was being taken advantage of and labeled literally the path of least resistance by a $1 billion conglomerate who wanted to build a pipeline through our neighborhood next to our schools, our elementary schools where our children go, up the parks where we play, and, you know, take people's property for pennies on a dollar. And so it literally was just a group of folks who were concerned and who cared about our community and who had lived there for generations, standing up and fighting against this big billionaire takeover. And we formed Memphis Community Against Pollution alongside my brother, who is now Representative Justin J. Pearson, and my parents. My mother really kicked everything off. Dr. Kimberly Owens Pearson now. And my father, they helped to steward us in a way that we cared. And, you know, in the South, you're not avoiding the Black church. And in the Black church, we've always been of the tradition that we care for the folks who are being taken advantage of and oppressed, even as we are being oppressed. And so in that vein, we started Memphis Community Against Pollution. We defeated that pipeline. It took about 9 months. I think it was the shortest pipeline fight ever in history. And from there, worked with the Environmental Protection Agency to create rules around ethylene oxide, because there was another facility in South Memphis polluting our air with toxic carcinogen, ethylene oxide. And so we got sterilization services of Tennessee kicked out. And now we are fighting against the literal wealthiest person on the planet, Elon Musk, and his XAI project that is polluting and poisoning our air with chemicals like formaldehyde or carcinogen and nitrogen oxide that causes smog and respiratory illnesses. And that all matters, right? These fights back to back to back, because our community already is under chronic stress from the pollution in the environment already. We have 17 toxic release facilities in our area, in 38109. Wow. And so that's resulted in our cancer rate is 4 times the national average. Our children are experiencing asthma emergencies at the highest rate in the state of Tennessee. And so we are in the midst of a public health crisis. And this project by Elon Musk and his billionaire friends is continuing to exacerbate what we're already struggling with. And Memphis Community Against Pollution has been created, right, to eliminate the pollution and to protect our people. And so that's what we're doing.
Wow. And so one of the things you said, Keyshawn, is that often these places of toxicity are in the communities where there is least resistance. In other words, these folks are going to be poor. They're not going to be able to organize. And mainly those communities are poor Black folks. But, you know, the situation like Coldwater Creek, those were predominantly a white community, white working class community, and they still caught hell. And so that point about the least resistance, I think, is real, because we'll never see these plants or any of this runoff be close to wealthy communities, because they just wouldn't stand for it. They just wouldn't stand for it. And so for us, that would be a Ladue, that would be a Chesterfield. Mm-hmm. And so so even when I think about Times Beach, that was a working class community of mainly white people, rural. And they basically, I mean, they put some kind of toxic spray the road with some dioxin and all kind of toxic stuff. And then when the flood came in 82, that toxic mix spread all over the town, the roads, and it took them years to do a buyout. But people were, this was considered, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Kristen, one of the worst man-made disasters, environmental disasters in this country. And that town does not exist anymore. So when I think about environmental justice, I think about black people, poor black people, because I'm thinking about, for example, Louisiana Alley, where, all those communities along the Mississippi have been exposed to all kinds of stuff. But I do want you all to respond to the vulnerability of these communities. Because when I think about, for example, COVID, and COVID, exposed a lot of the inequities, health inequities that we have, but also they exposed the environmental inequities that, communities are exposed to. So when something like a pandemic comes, we are going to be hit super hard. And so when you are looking at, and you talked about like the children and the impact on them, the asthma, and I have to know that there's going to be some impact on their ability to learn. So what are you all seeing in terms of already these health and life quality factors that then exposes people in a different kind of way to the toxins that these corporations and government are bringing into our communities? You want to start, Kristen?
Yes, sorry. Well, I will give you just a really quick example. I am in full agreement that, typically speaking, black and brown communities get it first and worst. I will say you are correct that our environmental contamination did start in a middle-class working white neighborhood. However, since then, white flight has happened from those neighborhoods, and now it is about a 50-50 mix. And one thing that we have noticed, and just going through old documents, it looks like when the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, took over the cleanup plan from the Department of Energy in 1997, that's when they started first noting the demographic change in the neighborhood. It's also when the Army Corps decided that they were going to increase the cleanup levels over there, or what would trigger a cleanup level, by over 180%, which according to the state's calculations would increase the cancer risk threefold. The Army Corps has since moved forward with that plan. We've also noted that since they've been in charge 1997, they do not estimate that their cleanup will be done until 2038. To your point about had this happened in Ladue or Chesterfield, I can only imagine that they would get the best cleanup possible and the fastest cleanup possible. And yet here we are almost 100 years later from the Manhattan Project by the time they get all this cleaned up. And that's 100 years that these communities mm-hmm. have been exposed. Mm-hmm. We have also just recently an elementary school closed down, a predominantly black elementary school in the Hazelwood School District for radioactive contamination. Unbeknownst to a lot of the families and even the school board at the time, the Army Corps had been on the property since 2015 doing tests, and parents were not made aware. The school board was not really made aware of what they were finding, and it took us as an organization submitting a Freedom of Information Act request just to get the data to show that, yes, there is contamination on this school property. And as I mentioned, after finding that out, the school district did make the a decision which dispersed 400 students into different schools. They already had been struggling after COVID just to get teachers and staff there. And now that they've just basically thrown all these students into already overpopulated classrooms, which in one sense is good because they're not being poisoned anymore, but it also is a huge strain on the district and the students and families.
And before I go to Keyshawn, I just want to go back to the white flight, because was the white flight a result of blacks coming in, or the fact that they were told that this place is toxic, you better get the hell out of here?
I would say probably You know, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I could speculate to say that it was Black families moving in, because I think at that time, most people in the community, and even to this day, a lot of people in the community aren't really fully aware of the contamination that exists mm-hmm. in their own neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. We went door to door as part of our organizing efforts a few summers ago and hit over 2,000 houses with information about this. And that's just a speck. When you look at the population in North County, mm-hmm. I think that just within 1 mile of Coldwater Creek, there are over 60,000 residents. And that's just within 1 mile of the creek. This is many municipalities. And so while we're proud of that number, 2,000, it is really still just a speck. And we're dedicated to getting back out with boots on the ground to keep informing the residents.
Wow. And so Keyshawn, in Memphis, which, you know, I think would have like higher poverty rates, higher health disparities, how is this kind of contamination impacting those communities?
Our communities, unfortunately, are and consistently hurt first, worst, in a lot of different ways. And I'll start by talking about a way that is not illuminated enough, and that's time poverty. We have so many folks who are experiencing medical issues because of this health crisis, and they are losing time because they have to care for loved ones, they have to travel, and they are missing school to take care of their kids or take them to doctor's appointments. And so this loss of time, people are not getting back. Mm-hmm. And then you have to look at the economic strangulation that's happening because of that. I've had my cousin lost a job because she had to take her daughter to a doctor's appointment because she had an asthma attack, right? She literally lost a job to care for her child because her child has asthma in a place where asthma has been exacerbated because of the pollution in the air, right? Just because of where you live, mm-hmm. now your economic mobility is confined. And so what we continue to see is not only are we bearing the body burden, right, by having the asthmas and having the allergies or having the eczema or having the cancer, we also are financially impacted, and we are losing in our quality of life because we don't have time to spend in places where we enjoy, and we don't have time to really invest in ourselves because we are experiencing such a detriment of time poverty because we have to take care of ailing family members or ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ramifications that continue to plague my community, can plague and plague our city. And what that translates to is increased crime, mm-hmm. right? Air pollution is literally tied to an increase in crime based on a study done by the World Economic Forum, right? And 96% of Black communities experience more death due to air pollution than any other community in the country, and this is based on a Stanford review. And so we are dying at the hands of pollution. We are dying in order that these projects continue to move forward. And this extraction of our life, our livelihoods, our quality of life is something that has not been reckoned with or reconciled or repaired, right? These companies are getting away with trampling on poor people, and especially poor Black people here. Absolutely. And that has to stop.
Well, you know, I think about what you said, and when people think of the environment, sometimes they're thinking about like, oh, they want to keep the clean streams or getting the water bottles out of the ocean. But this comes so close to home. When you turn on that water faucet, you don't know what the hell you're getting. When you are getting crops and food from the dirt, you don't know what's been lingering there. And so, for example, in St. Louis, where lead poisoning dominated the housing stock in St. Louis, particularly for poor families, we started to see that rise, Keyshawn, in criminality. And there were studies done that said most of the folks who came from Missouri, particularly St. Louis, who were in incarcerated had high levels of lead. Because lead, there's no turning back on that. There's no remediation. Once it gets in the brain, it's there and it's going to stay there. So I think the point that you're making is one that I think it's hard for us to pass on to our people who are already struggling day to day to say, here's another something you got to be worried about. And so for me as an organizer, you know, you have to find ways to meet people where they are and talk about it, where they are when they start to experience it. But some people are proactive and they say, okay, I know what's getting ready to happen here to this community. And they start to organize. But I think even in the midst of all the other stuff that we have to deal with on a daily basis, that's still a struggle. So I know for Kristen, she's a victim of the environmental, you know, crises. And I wanted her to talk a little bit about that because sometimes people get involved because they get personally involved. And sometimes people get involved because they see what's going on. And it seems like you all might have those two different perspectives. So Kristen, talk about what's going on in your personal life with what you're suffering with based on some of this toxins.
Sure. I actually grew up, my family is a lifelong St. Louisans. We grew up in North County, where most of this waste is concentrated. Grew up playing in Coldwater Creek. I also grew up near the Westlake Landfill, where it's still experiencing an underground fire, which also increased our asthma rates. On that note, I had a small daughter at the time living next to the landfill. She was diagnosed with exercise-induced asthma, but we knew that it was actually coming from the sulfur dioxide emitted from the landfill fire. We since moved, and she, to that point, she has never used her inhaler since. But now I have to also wonder, what else was she exposed to? We know that there is the Manhattan Project radioactive waste also within this landfill. There is major corporations just dumped when this was still unregulated. We have pesticides, herbicides, anything you can think of. So now that's always in the back of my mind, well, what was she exposed to before we moved? From my personal health journey, back in 2012, I started within an 11-month period. I had to have my gallbladder removed, total hysterectomy due to masses on my ovaries and stage 4 endometriosis. I had a tumor on my left adrenal gland that they had to remove the entire adrenal gland. And then I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. They also had to remove that. Thyroid cancer is directly attributed to radiation exposure. And then within just a few months after that, they found a new tumor on my remaining adrenal gland and a lesion inside my liver. The last two, the right adrenal gland and lesion in my liver, I basically just have to monitor for the rest of my life, kind of waiting for that shoe to drop. It's very heavy and hard to constantly have that weight on your mind. I've also started to, because of all these different primary issues that required lifelong medication after the fact, and scans to watch, I have started to ration my care simply because I cannot afford it. Mm. I also just recently, my father, who also grew up near the waste in Berkeley, was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer that has spread to his brain. Mm. And the other, you know, while it motivated me, I think, to do something, I felt like this was our home and people weren't really doing much about it. And I wanted to get involved as much as possible. In the last 12 years, I have met so many people who have been affected by this radioactive legacy. You can really just, once you get on the ground and start talking to people, I don't believe that there's a North County resident or St. Louis resident for that matter, that hasn't been affected by this at some point. And that's why we've worked really hard. We're trying to get St. Louis and St. Charles included in the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which would allow for one compensation for developing, certain cancers that the federal government recognizes as being attributed to radiation, And then also it allows for free medical screenings, which to Keyshawn's point, you know, this is an accumulative burden that we're all experiencing here. Whether it's, you know, missing work, having to pay for all these different medical tests, putting food on the table. There's all these different things we have to focus on. And I think bringing in these medical screenings will help get people to the doctor, and to hopefully find these illnesses before they get worse, and potentially even life-threatening. Unfortunately, that bill, it had passed twice in the Senate, Speaker Johnson failed to pick it up in the House, and the bill essentially died. But we are still working to try to get it passed. I think that each time we go to D.C., we get more and more support for it. But I think it would be extremely helpful for the people here in St. Louis to not only compensate them for their illnesses and their losses, but also just to get them to the doctor.
But you know what?
Get them the treatment that they deserve.
And obviously that is another tool in the toolbox that we'll use, and that is to go to the legislature. But I'm just going back to Sean's point about the loss of life and the loss of quality of life. No compensation can really deal with that. I mean, most of the time caretakers die early deaths because of the stress and strain that they're under taking care of loved ones. And so these are the kinds of things that don't get factored in terms of the literal cost. And I also would say that even some of the deaths that happen don't get attributed to environmental issues. It's like, oh, they died of cancer, or oh, they died of, you know, heart disease, when all of these things are because of their exposure. And even for all the things that you talked about, as you were talking, I was like, oh, man, all of those are affecting organs that are part of the immune system. And so those systems mm-hmm. have to start working overtime to keep those toxins from really just ravaging the body. And once those get so full of the toxins, then the floodgates are open then. And so here's my next question, y'all. We have corporations who do this and sometimes knowingly do it. And then their hope is that nobody will figure it out before they make all their tons of money, or they do it with the complicity of the U.S. government, which in the case here, where you had the Manhattan Project, and you know, if anybody's seen those images of those hundreds and hundreds of barrels just leaking into the soil, I mean, it just, you know, you just want to go find somebody, but you know, it's not just one person. It's like a system. And so
it's a whole system.
A whole system that's fighting against you. So what have been your pathways to really organize and relief and remediation for these areas and for human beings who are suffering? Because I know when I talked to Tina, it was such a struggle for them to get the government to recognize that they had harmed people. So therefore, they could never get compensation. They could never get the medical care that they really need. And to me, that part of the government's piece in here is just criminal. So what have you all encountered on both sides, in Memphis and here in Missouri?
Keyshawn, you want to take it first?
I'll let you go first, Chris.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. I actually agree with Tina. It has been very difficult to even get the government to acknowledge what was done. Even to this day, the agencies that are involved in cleaning it up, they acknowledge that it's there. They acknowledge that they did this thing. But to actually acknowledge that they harmed us is a whole other story. And while I think we have built support just by bringing people to the Capitol, by bringing people to their, you know, basically right to the face-to-face conversation, I still think one of the biggest obstacles we have run into is just acknowledging that the harm was done. And even really truly acknowledging St. Louis's role. I think that's been one of our biggest issues. And I think Tina can probably attest to this as well. You know, a lot of focus is on the Nevada test sites, where it's more well known, but for New Mexico and Missouri, we were literally the first, and yet we're being ignored and left out of the story. Mm. And so really just getting the acknowledgement mm-hmm. of our roles and what's going on here, even though we have government documents, we have maps showing where they're finding waste, we have, you know, health agencies saying, yes, you have a higher risk of cancer here. But to actually get them to acknowledge it and to want to do something about it, I think that's the wall we're running into. You know, like I said, we've gotten it passed through the Senate, but for the most part, the House has just ignored us. And that is where the most members are. That's where we need the support from. But I do think organizing, and I do think getting the masses to these people and allowing space. I mean, we rented a bus at one point to take community members to our state capitol to testify in front of a hearing about our the effects of what was going on here. It's things like that are helped the movement and getting the people in front of them. But again, it's been an uphill battle, and I would be naive to say that we have been successful. Mm-hmm. I think we're gaining momentum, but it's still mm-hmm. an uphill battle for sure.
Right. What about you, Sean?
And so what I would say first to Kristen is that y'all have been successful. The organizing of human beings on a cause that is so important to be able to do that work and even make it to how far you have is a success, right? I don't think in environmental justice spaces or in justice spaces we celebrate the successes enough. Because it can be overwhelming to constantly fight, but we have succeeded even in marginal ways in moving the lever forward. But this world didn't look like it did before your organization was started, right? It's changed in so many ways because of that work. And so first, I just want to say that. And
appreciate you. Thank you.
Of course. And so what I would say to that question is that basically to affirm, you know, some of the things that Kristen already said, there is a severe lack of accountability to the people who have redlined our communities in a way that allows industry to do what they're doing. There's a lack of accountability of the officials, whether local, state, federal, who have, you know, turned a blind eye to these corporations who take advantage, who create even more suffering. Through the polluting of our air, our water, and our soil. This is our environment. We don't have anywhere else to go, mm-hmm. right? And we should not be displaced from our ancestral homes just so they can continue to build the factories that we know exacerbate climate change. Right? Our planet is suffering consistently. And the things that we are missing look like repair and redress, right? There have been no attempts. When I say no, I mean zero absolute attempts at our elected officials or otherwise to try and repair the relationships with the community in a significant way that addresses the pain, the suffering that they are experiencing due to the chronic health issues that we have. There are no free medical, you know, mm-hmm. Folks driving around to give us services or increase testing for our area. Like, there are so many options for repair and what redress could look like financially or health-wise that aren't being explored. It is literally just allowing these corporations to cut a check and then to continue to do what they're doing and oppressing our people. And so with all that Kristen is carrying and holding, I also have lost both of my grandmothers to cancers. Mm. Right. And they only lived a mile and a half apart. They both lived in 38109, lived, worked, played, grew families, and they died of cancer because of this concentration of pollution. Like, this is not something that folks are talking about because it is something that we're reading about. It is literally affecting us every single day. My brother who passed away, Temperance Darnell Pearson Sr., and he passed away in December of last year, but he had asthma, chronic asthma, right? But when we moved to Northern Virginia, there was less pollution, and he never needed an asthma pump. We moved back home, and he needed his asthma pump again. Mm. And so it is a necessity that these government institutions look at how to repair the damage that's being done. And for us at Memphis Community Against Pollution, we need a reduction in the pollution that is concentrated in 38109, but we also need that repair and that redress that looks like increased health care, increased screenings. Mm-hmm. What we have is that studies, we have facts, right? We've presented everything to go and illuminate just how bad this crisis is. And unfortunately, our leadership doesn't have the moral courage. Our leader of our Shelby County Health Department said to us, it's because people are eating too much food on the grill. Too much chicken and meat. That's what's causing the cancer. Mm-hmm. Not the Valero oil refinery that's right up the street from Nucor Steel Mill, that's right up the street from the Tennessee Valley Authority combined cycle plant, that's right on the same street as the Maxon wastewater treatment facility. It's not that. It's because of your diet. And this victim blaming is completely ridiculous. And that is something that we have to continue to address, as we are also demanding the repair that we deserve.
Well, when it comes to, and I'm just reeling from you all's losses in terms of your family, and then I'm looking at multiplying that like exponentially for other families and realizing that people are dying premature deaths.
Sorry, I lost you.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I'm still here with you. I think we lost Jamala.
You lost me? Can you hear me now?
I'm really sorry for your loss, by the way.
Can you all hear
Thank
me now?
You. And
yeah, so what
I'm sorry for what you were experiencing as well. I know, like I said, you know, it no one gets a cancer treatment or a serious medical issue diagnosis alone. That's a diagnosis for the family,
mm-hmm.
right? And everybody carries it, and the community carries it. And so, you know, it is this idea that our lives, for whatever reason or another, aren't as valuable as theirs or wealthier people or somebody else. We human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And for that simple fact alone, we deserve clean air, clean water, clean soil, and to live in an environment that doesn't kill us, that isn't killing us actively.
Literally.
Unfortunately, we don't have the money, as these lobbyists do, the ones that these corporations can send in to our elected officials and ways, as you said, they don't have the moral courage.
And that's the thing. Exactly. Right? We, our existence isn't transactional.
Mm-hmm.
If you represent people, then you represent people. It shouldn't matter who pays you what, because you don't represent them. These aren't people.
But sometimes
these are not your constituents. And so, so life cannot become this transactional game of who can afford to survive.
Right.
Well, I think it was either you or Jamala that said, you know, a lot of the times this is that these corporations, they don't view us as people. They view us as, you know, a statistic or a dot on some map somewhere. And we unfortunately, you know, they look at it as, well, you know, we'll make this profit before people get sick and then we'll be gone and we won't have to deal with it. Or like in our case where we have these corporations who have been indemnified because they were contracted through the government. The government gives them
right
to do whatever they want. And that mm-hmm. seems to be a lot of the way the federal government operates, is they contract out private corporations mm-hmm. and then exempt them from any sort of liability. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's very difficult to sue the federal government. So at this point, we're left standing here with nothing except for heartache and pain.
That's it.
So I wanted to intervene. Can you all hear me?
Degrading environment, right? We're dealing with hotter days, longer, hotter days, costing us more to cool down, more to just simply exist in any type of equanimity. It's just extremely frustrating because even like now, under this regime, now the federal government is literally a weapon alongside the corporation, right? You could worry, you know, initially it was these people or those people, but the totality of our government has been co-opted. And it just exacerbates what is wrong with what's happening. And I think what's happening with XAI here in Memphis is just the most stark example of how wealth and oligarchs have really taken this opportunity to take advantage of people and to oppress people in a way that is immoral and disgraceful. But it truly is their vision of the future. I really see that. At our expense.
Are you all able to hear me now? Expense. Can you hear me now?
But this is what I will say, though. You know, the future is a co-created experiment and experience. And so the hope, the strength that I find is in the fact that no one person has been on the vision. No one person is going to be crafting it. And so it's more of us than it is of them. And we have to create something that reflects us, that protects us, that heals us. And every step of the way.
Please enter your password, then press pound.
Selves, or, you know, creating policy, or even just creating community. Mm-hmm. Every single step matters, because that's the future we're going to end up living in.
Please enter your password, then press pound.
Thing that communities are doing against it, and the community that people are finding out in the streets and with each other and through
mutual aid,
and just being like, for example, you know, we just had a huge tornado come through here, and you know, our local governments, our federal government, obviously, didn't step up. It took weeks and weeks and weeks, and it was people on the ground. It was the people's response that got people through, handing out food, helping clear debris, going door to door, asking community members what they needed, you know, and spending their own money, their own time and energy to help a community in need. And I think that is, I agree with you, that is what's powerful and will move us forward and hopefully create that brighter, more hopeful future that we all deserve.
Can you all hear me now?
Amen.
Can you all hear me now?
Well, I wonder where Jamala went.
Right. Jamala.
You all can't hear me?
We are still here.
I wonder if we're actually live.
Yes,
oh,
you
that
are.
That would be cool. That would actually be cool, because, you know, I think that's what we're going to end up talking about. I think that's what we're going to end up talking about. But I haven't got a text or anything.
Mm-mm.
Have you?
No.
And I'm kind of scared to hang up, but I'll see if I can send a text. Okay, I just sent a text.
Can you all hear me now?
I mean, I think we're all still, I mean, the fact that you and I can still talk, she must be still connected somehow.
Right. I'm thinking the phone is connected. Phone is connected to, I guess, whatever device. I haven't done many of these.
No, me either.
Still learning. Yeah, I think there, but going back to what we were talking about, I think one of the first steps in accountability is like just a real recognizing the fact that we are in a public health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not normal. This is not business as usual. And also recognizing the climate catastrophe is now. Like, it is not coming. It is right now. The way the storms are happening, the migration that's happening, like, this is real. This is not you know, something that you're reading about may happen. This is actively happening. And so that's something that has to be addressed. And I think that would be a great first step for even municipalities and local governments to be, to just outright, you know, recognize it and say it and operate in that way. You know, we can't continue to try to mask reality of what is happening and how it can continue to get worse if we ignore what's happening.
Right. And I think, unfortunately, the issue has become political when in reality it's existential. I think that this is for all of humanity across the globe. Clearly, it's not a a political thing. I will say, just a quick shout out to one of my coworkers, Elise Schaefer. She is currently writing a an urban heat climate plan for the city of St. Louis. We're also trying to get in front of the county about the issue. I know that there was a bill in our county council to start working on their own climate plan. It had since been split up. I think it's still moving forward, but I'm not exactly sure where that bill lies right now in the county. But I absolutely agree with you. It is at a county level. We all need to start addressing it, and then county by county, state by state, federal government by federal government. Again, it's not political. It is an existential humanitarian crisis.
That's it. Can't put it no better than that. That is literally it.
The earth will do just fine without us. It's humanity that's going to suffer through this.
That's right. Okay, so I did get a message back.
Okay.
From Jay. And so what we want to, what we want to close with, maybe, I don't know if it's going to take 7 minutes, but the administration has made a lot of ridiculous cuts, you know, across different organizations. And I think the one that really affects what's happening here in Memphis and what affects your work is the cuts to the EPA, especially the environmental justice arm of the EPA. You know, your own words, how do you think that will shape fights for environmental justice over the next, you know, years or so, and see opportunities?
Well, to the point about the cutting the EPA, I think I've already seen that. We participated in a government accountability investigation in the Army Corps Engineers Formally Utilized Sites Remedial Action Program, which is the agency tasked to clean up this radioactive waste in our community. And at least one of the five recommendations that came out of that was an acknowledgement that the neighborhoods would have fallen under the Justice 40 initiative. But since that has now been rolled back, the Army Corps no longer has to.
Password. Then press pound.
Rolled back is to acknowledge the fact that this is an impoverished area. The other thing is, you know, I will say Senator Hawley did get the EPA administration.
Password. Then press pound. I'm sorry. This number is not valid. Please enter your password. Then
here in St. Louis, now I recognize that that might also come at the expense of other communities across the nation, which is terrible. I believe that it's a either or. I think it's an and both situation. We need to be addressing all of these things. Also, with the rollback of funding, I have personally seen a lot of really great grassroots organizations here in St. Louis and other people lose funding and lose their jobs and their ability to keep work. And I think that have a huge effect on the ground.
You know, any light for opportunities for things to change?
It seems bleak right now with this administration and wanting to even open up like public lands for drilling and for the fossil fuel companies. But I do think the hope lies in the people. And I think that we will continue to organize and continue to do this work and help each other through this. And I think a lot of these will be, you know, temporary setbacks, temporary hardships. And hopefully, as I said, the people will continue let's organize and work together, and we'll stay strong and maintain through this, these setbacks, and see some light at the end of this tunnel.
That's the truth. And for me, I think everything you said was really spot on. What I've noticed, right, and we've been able to have a front row seat here in Memphis because the organizations like the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States have been so many ways, and especially with the job cuts, but also the language, the removal of language around environmental justice and injustice work is something that is going to take years to reestablish. And it's something that we have to be extremely intentional on holding on to. But this federal exploitation of the institutions that were created in order to protect our environment, to protect our energy grid, to protect our health, that will allow for what's happening in Memphis to happen. XAI right now is using up to 33 methane gas turbines 24/7 with not a permit from Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, not a permit from the Shelby County Health Department, who oversees our air pollution and water controls, not a single permit. But they're putting more toxins in the air in the form of nitrogen oxide, somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 tons per year of nitrogen oxide in our air without a permit. This is more than the Memphis International Airport. Right. And then you also see formaldehyde, 17.2 tons per year by this facility. Now, this facility has been in Memphis on June 5th. From their announcement a year ago, they've been here 12 months in a couple of days. And within that time, they built a power plant and armed all of these methane gas burning turbines that not only cause all of the health issues and exacerbate them through the air pollution, but it also has greenhouse gases, because methane gas also leaks in these devices, and methane gas is a greenhouse gas, right? And so the cumulative effect of eroding our democracy, the ecological devastation that we're experiencing, and the public health crisis that is exacerbating. All of these things are happening because the wealthy are in charge. Mm-hmm. And for me, the idea that the power is with the wealthy is that we have to actively show them is incorrect. The power is always with the people. And the power is always with the people. Power is with the people. Power has always been with the people. And it is time that we take that back. I think for a while it has been, or folks have got discouraged, but we have to hold on to that and keep moving in that faith.
And I would like to add really quickly to that, that Jamala bringing us together today from across, you know, states here.
Thank you, Jamala.
Yes, thank you so much for that, because I think this is connecting the people to the, you know, together, because
that's right.
That is the whole point, is they want to silo us. They want to keep us in these separate little groups and blaming each other or fighting each other. But in reality, if we can all come together nationally and start saying the same thing, start working towards the same benefits, then we do have that power. Just as you said, I think we can make meaningful changes and work together. And I'm so grateful that we were brought together today.
Yes, he is grateful. And we will stay connected. Thank you so much for your testimony, your story.
Right now.